we have enough to comply with and to figure out and how to catch a few fish and how to make some money.
Congress gives Alaska's commercial fishermen a 3-year reprieve from an EPA regulation. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, December 10th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the state faces some hurdles before Medicaid expansion can happen.
I think the situation is a lot more dire than we anticipated last week. So we have some pretty significant concerns.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com.
And by
the Fish Basket Coalition, working to secure a bright future for Bristol Bay and the Bering Sea, where fishing means business. Visit fishbasket.org to learn more.
Police in Barrow say a convicted felon shot and killed a state assistant prosecutor in a jealous rage over a woman. Murder charges were filed today in the community against 47-year-old Ronald Fisher in the death of 48-year-old Assistant District Attorney Brian Sullivan. North Slope Borough Police say Sullivan was killed Monday night in the Barrow home of a woman who had a past relationship with Fisher. Investigators say Sullivan was unarmed and seated on a couch when he was struck twice with blasts from a 20-gauge shotgun fired by Fisher. They say security video from a nearby store shows Fisher entering the home. Sullivan was an Army veteran and former Washington State House representative. The U.S. Senate today passed a Coast Guard bill that includes a 3-year moratorium on vessel discharge regulations for boats 79 feet and smaller. The House is expected to pass it this week, too. If the moratorium doesn't pass by December 19th, Alaska's fishing fleet will have to comply with new regulations the industry claims are unworkable. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, an effort to permanently kill the regulations failed to get through.
Senator Barbara Boxer's bill would have lifted the small vessel discharge regs entirely, but the California Democrat said from the Senate floor she had to settle for a 3-year reprieve.
It's the best we can do, and I want the American people and the fishermen to know we tried so hard to get this fixed permanently.
The bill passed the Senate by consent with no vote. The threat of EPA regulation for incidental vessel discharges has been hanging over Alaska's fishermen for years. The rules would apply to all kinds of fluids that flow from fishing boats, including bilge water, fish hold effluent, and deck wash. Homer fisherman Buck Lokaitis read the regulations the EPA drafted and says the quarterly inspections they require would have been difficult. Lokaitis says the rules were baffling, too.
I mean, do you have grease coming out of the shaft of your boat, you know, the propeller shaft? Well, I don't know. Do I have to dive on that and find out?
The EPA estimates compliance would cost boat owners less than $140 a year. But Lokaitis, whose boat was in Accutan unloading cod as he spoke, says fishermen will have dodged a huge bullet if the moratorium clears Congress.
We have enough to comply with and to figure out and how to catch a few fish and how to make some money, let alone, you know, having a full-time compliance officer trying to keep track of an EPA permit.
Republican Senator David Vitter from Louisiana offered the 3-year fix the Senate passed. He didn't explain why it was preferable to permanently lifting the regulation for fishing boats and other commercial vessels. Senator Boxer alleges lawmakers aim to use the measure as future leverage.
I don't think they're really objections to the permanency. They're political objections to try and use this to get some other bad stuff attached to it, and I'm not going to let that happen.
In Congress, the small vessel discharge regs have been politically linked to rules for ship ballast water. Boxer has insisted on strict rules for ballast water, which can transfer non-native invasive species from one port to another. Senator Lisa Murkowski says the discharge regulations would affect thousands of Alaska's commercial fishermen. Murkowski says she'll work for a permanent fix when the new Congress convenes in January.
We don't need to inject this uncertainty into the operations of our hardworking fishing families. We need to have a permanent solution.
Murkowski says it will require addressing the ballast water problem, too. The vessel discharge moratorium is in a bill that keeps the Coast Guard underway for 2 years. Its sponsor, Senator Mark Begich, says the bill authorizes $1 billion more than the White House requested to modernize the Coast Guard with new cutters and aircraft. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
A new fiscal analysis of the Susitna-Watonna hydroelectric project questions the Alaska Energy Authority's estimates regarding how much the 735-foot-tall dam would cost the state of Alaska if built. KTNA's Philip Manning reports.
On Monday, economist Greg Erickson released his analysis of the financial picture of the Susitna-Watonna hydroelectric project. The report was commissioned by Trout Unlimited, a conservation group that opposes the project. Erickson has worked for the University of Alaska Anchorage, a Washington, D.C. think tank, and in multiple roles for the state of Alaska. He says that, from his perspective, Susitna-Watonna doesn't pencil out.
There is no market test that this proposed project meets. There's every evidence that they've underestimated the cost and overestimated the demand, and doesn't seem at all likely that the project could be built without very, very large amounts of state subsidy.
Greg Erickson says the Alaska Energy Authority and its predecessor, the Alaska Power Authority, have a history of projects going over budget, including Bradley Lake and the Healy Clean Coal Plant. Wayne Dyock, project manager for Susitna-Watonna, maintains that AEA believes its $5.2 billion estimate is reasonable for construction of the proposed dam. He says that claim is backed up by a third-party review.
We want to make sure that our cost estimates are right on the money, and that's why we requested an independent, you know, cost estimate, and you know they came in, you know, within around 10% of one another.
One of the issues cited in Erickson's report is the fact that that independent analysis has not been made public. Wayne Dyock says AEA plans to release a feasibility report next month that will include the methodology for estimating the cost of Susitna-Watonna, as well as information regarding the third-party analysis. Like Trout Unlimited, who commissioned the highly critical report by Erickson, the Talkeetna-based Susitna River Coalition is opposed to the building of Susitna-Watonna. Mike Wood is the coalition's president. He was handing out copies of the report at MATSU legislative offices on Monday afternoon. Wood says Erickson's analysis gives strength to the opposition arguments based not just on conservation, but also on cost.
What it really comes down to is economics. And all along, that should have been the first question we were asking. The state was asking itself, what is this project going to cost? It never should have even gotten to the environmental part.
Beyond Greg Erickson's analysis, another potential concern for AEA is state funding to continue studies for Susitna-Watonna. In the last 5 years, the state has spent over $190 million on the project. According to AEA, an additional $90 million is needed in order to complete federally required field studies. The proposed budget left behind by the Parnell administration for the next fiscal year includes just $20 million for Susitna-Watonna. If that number doesn't go up significantly, it could mean additional delays for the project. Wayne Dyock says AEA plans to work with Governor Walker and legislators to keep Susitna moving forward.
Our goal is to work with the administration and ultimately the legislature to come up with the right number for the coming year.
In the meantime, the Alaska Energy Authority is considering long-term financial options. Wayne Dyock says the AEA Board of Directors will meet later this month to discuss the fiscal outlook. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a rare December catch on the Eek River.
And I looked at it, and it was a silver sam. I was just surprised and said, holy cow, look what I got.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Laborers Local 71 and the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities ask you to slow down in construction zones while they work to keep roads safe. Alaska Laborers Local 71, working hard for Alaska. This message is sponsored by Alaska Laborers Local 71.
Since the election, new Governor Bill Walker has been piecing together his cabinet. But a few positions still remain in question. Key among these is the job of National Guard Adjutant General, who also serves as Commissioner of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. Walker's Republican predecessor, Sean Parnell, was in the process of finding a new Adjutant General at the time of the election. Parnell had asked then-Adjutant General Thomas Katkus to resign in September because of a devastating federal report on sexual assault and favoritism in the Guard. Second-in-command Mike Bridges was promoted to the position in an acting role. Bridges remains in the position today, but Walker says he will be reviewing candidates for the job next week, and a decision should be made shortly after.
It's in the works. We expect that in the next, certainly in the next 30 days.
Walker says he plans to meet with the investigating team from the National Guard Bureau Monday. He says they will start by looking at the applicant pool Parnell collected before he considers soliciting additional names.
Well, we want to see first what the group was that was brought to us. We haven't seen that, or we haven't gone through that yet. And also the process that was used. We want to make sure that it was broad enough to make sure it would include Alaskans as well.
Walker has kept Parnell's Education Commissioner Mike Hanley and his Environmental Conservation Commissioner Larry Hartig in acting roles. He says he's seriously considering keeping both of them in permanent roles. Valerie Davidson has been one of the biggest advocates in the state for Medicaid expansion. Now, implementing that expansion is one of her top priorities as Alaska's new Commissioner of Health and Social Services. Another focus for Davidson will be child welfare. She just served on the U.S. Attorney General's Advisory Committee on Native Children Exposed to Violence. Davidson started in the job on December 1st. She says when she accepted the appointment, she consulted her two daughters and her mom.
I told my mom and I said, well, Okuf, you know, Mom, what do you think? And she said, well, we Yupiks were very hard to impress. I said, okay, Mom, you know, that's fair. And then she thought about it for a while. She's very Yupik. She's from Guigin Lokokubach is her name, Tilly. And she said, but, you know, you're a really hard worker. And you'll work hard and you'll do a good job and I'll help you. And I said, okay, you know, thank you, Mom, that's fair. And growing up, you know, doing subsistence fishing in the summer, her rule always was, if you're old enough to walk, you're old enough to help. And I think, you know, growing up in that kind of household with that really strong work ethic and that emphasis on working together in community, I think, is something that will actually be really helpful in this new job.
Well, it does sound like an excellent upbringing for taking on such an enormous job. What do you think the biggest challenge will be in this position?
Well, I think in terms of the department, I mean, we have two major opportunities that are particular passions of mine. The first is Medicaid expansion, and then the other is child welfare issues.
What do you think the first steps will be to start putting that expansion in place?
Well, in order to implement Medicaid expansion successfully, we have to make sure that we have systems in place that will allow us to be successful on the very first day we go live. And in order to do that, we have two systems. One is the eligibility system, which is the system that allows people to apply for Medicaid. And we also need to be able to ensure that the second system for provider payments is also working. And unfortunately, we have significant challenges in both of those areas. In terms of eligibility, I think the situation is a lot more dire than we anticipated last week. So we have some pretty significant concerns. Where we are now is we are doing our fact-finding and getting in there and figuring out the extent of the challenge before we can craft some solutions that will allow us to be able to address those challenges and be able to move forward. We want to make sure that we implement correctly, so that when we're not rushing to start and then we've created this fallout of sloppy implementation on the back end. So we want it to work for families.
Do you have concerns about the temperature of the legislature, whether or not they are needed to implement the expansion? What are your thoughts about making sure that they're supportive of it, and how would you work to ensure that they would be?
Well, I think that, you know, we certainly want to be able to work with the legislature. I think Governor Walker is a very collaborative, open person, and I think he's looking forward to that opportunity. And, you know, alas, this is not the first time that Alaska has faced tough decisions and tough budget years about health issues or about any other issues. And one thing I've seen over time is that the more people we can bring to the table to have that conversation, to participate in sharing their views, whether they think it's a wonderful thing or a terrible thing, the better opportunity we have to be able to shape policy. And it may not be something that everyone's 100% happy with, but it may be something that we may be able to find middle ground that we can all live with. And I think that's what makes Alaska so great, is that we do that all the time. We're not shy about, we don't back down just because things get difficult. If it's 40 below, we go about our day and we get things done. That's just what we do. And we do that with policy issues as well.
Office of Children's Services is under your purview. Do you think that there were elements of the federal task force that you were part of that might help inform how you'll make decisions or go forward with kind of bringing some of that into working with children through OCS?
Well, yes, absolutely. You know, one of the things that the advisory committee recommended is that we need to do things that have worked well in the tribal health system, for example, in the health area, where you provide services as close to home as possible. And so adjudicating child welfare cases as close to home as possible means that we can do things differently, but that also requires for some barriers to be removed. Now, you certainly can't make any broad sweeping, oh yes, we have to make sure that every child stays in the community, because I think sometimes I'm not in a position to be able to say that we should do that every time, but I think that in other environments, we've seen that when you can provide care as close to home as possible, it makes a difference for kids. It's a lot less traumatic, and it also provides accountability for the community so that they know where these children are and what the processes were and what the factors were considered as well.
The budget's certainly going to be a very large issue. Are you anticipating that the health department is going to have to look for places to cut?
Well, again, we're very early in the budget process, and I think, you know, at this point, I really can't say. I do know that one of the challenges we have in the Department of Health and Social Services is that a lot of the programs really are programs that serve children and programs that serve families. And so as we're making those decisions and as the legislature is making decisions about where we need to trim, we also have to be cognizant of the fact that these are real people, these are real children, and these are real families that will be impacted. And so we look forward to an opportunity to be able to have that conversation out in the open.
Valerie Davidson is the Commissioner of Health and Social Services. Her appointment needs to be confirmed by the legislature.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Winter is a time to focus on home and family, a time for eating good food and telling stories. This season, the Salmon Project is thankful to be sharing Alaskan salmon stories from around the state. The Salmon Project celebrates Alaskans' deep personal relationships with salmon as food, a source of pride, a way of life, and as the focus of a lot of fun. To read Alaskan stories or share your own, visit salmonproject.org/story. Salmon, it runs deep in all of us. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
The Fairbanks man who was buried in an avalanche near Isabel Pass on Saturday and lived to tell about it says he's learned that even an experienced backcountry skier can get into trouble. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
3 days after digging himself out from under a mountainside of snow, 63-year-old Michael Hopper speaks quietly and calmly about the near-death encounter that's shaken his confidence.
I'm going back to the drawing board is what this experience has taught me, and as I learn more about what actually happened in the accident.
Hopper's also taken advanced avalanche training, so by anyone's estimation, he's an able, if not expert, backcountry skier. And he knew the potential for peril in the area, so a few years ago, he built a cabin in case he got into trouble.
Eastern Alaska Range is a tough place. It's cold and windy and tricky, and you need a place to retreat to.
Hopper says after all that time, he came to love the area. So a few years ago, he and his wife Annie built the lodge at Black Rapids, about 15 miles north of Rainbow Ridge, where they spend part of their time when he's not at his psychology practice in Fairbanks. He says he and his companions were itching to get going Saturday for the first real outing of the season after the area finally got some measurable snowfall.
We were anxious to get going. We didn't ski all last year, so that was some of what was motivating me and Eric.
Hopper says he wanted to get back into the area because he hadn't been able to ski there since early last year due to the odd weather that set in last winter, starting with rainfall just after the holidays.
And in January, it rained, and I went back up into that valley, attempted to go the next day, or a couple days afterwards, and the entire valley, every spine that came down had avalanched. It was like glaciers and just cars carved down that hole. It was impassable.
Hopper says he now realizes that backcountry skiers need to take into account the changing climate when traversing that area.
I think if you talk to most Alaskans, it's pretty evident that it's much more erratic. We're getting rain. We never had that.
He says as bad as the events of Saturday night were, they could have been worse.
See, my son was supposed to have skiing with me on this trip. It was his 20th birthday. Fortunately, he had a curling competition, which they won. And that's one thing I'm eternally grateful for.
A benefit for the family of Eric Peterson will be held Saturday at the Black Rapids Lodge. The Hoppers have also set up an account at Mount McKinley Bank for donations to help defray the Peterson family's expenses. More information is available on the lodge's Facebook page. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
An Eek ice fisherman jigging for pike was surprised to hook a silver salmon last week. KYUK's Charles Enoch has more.
On the ice fishing trip last Friday, Eek resident Floyd Earle says he caught a couple of pikes, then dropped his jigging line into a hole, hoping for a third pike, but he got something else.
I felt something really jerk hard, and I was thinking, holy cow, I got a big pike. And I pulled it up, and I looked at it, and it was a silver salmon. I was just surprised and said, holy cow, look what I got.
Roll says the silver salmon was turned pink by the fresh water but was in good condition, only fatter. The majority of silver salmon swim up the Kuskokwim to spawn in August, but United States Fish and Wildlife biologist Lewis Coggins says some run late.
There are quite a few examples where coho salmon will be found spawning late into November and even into December.
Coggins says the areas that support later salmon runs are springs or upwellings in the river, saying these places tend to stay warmer than other areas. Roll said his friends and family members were extremely surprised, having never seen a freshly caught silver or coho salmon in December. Having not fished for salmon during the summer, Roll and his wife plan to make salmon soup for a memorable meal over a story that many would consider a fish tale. In Bethel, I'm Charles Enoch.
Port Chilcoot Distillery in Haines is the only craft distillery in Southeast. Distilleries in the state have not been able to sell their spirits on site, but a law passed earlier this year removes that restriction. KHNS's Emily Files has the story.
I just can't believe we made it happen. I thought it would take at least another year.
Heather Shade is in the Port Chilcoot Distillery near the huge stills where she crafts spirits. She's remembering the lobbying effort she coordinated with the four other Alaska distilleries, along with tourism groups and local chambers of commerce.
It kind of felt like it was just going to die every step of the way. And so when it passed unanimously through the Senate floor 2 days before the end of the legislative session, it just felt surreal.
Now distilleries in Alaska can sell limited amounts of their own products on location, just like wineries and breweries like Haynes Brewing Company have done for years. Shade thinks the change in Alaska's distillery laws is a result of a growing state and nationwide craft distillery industry. 3 years ago, there was only one distillery in Alaska. Now there are five. Shade says the main reason they wanted a tasting room is so they could participate in the tourism industry. This past summer, visitors would come to the distillery and ask for tours. After seeing and smelling what they were making, many people wanted a taste.
I just had to tell them that I'm sorry, Alaska state law only allows us to produce and we can't sell you anything.
Last year, Port Chilkoot and other Alaska distilleries started reaching out to their local senators and representatives. Shade invited Representative Jonathan Christ Tompkins to the distillery. Soon after, Anchorage Representative Chris Tuck introduced House Bill 309, which Christ Tompkins signed on to as a co-sponsor. Shade formed the Distillers Guild of Alaska and coordinated the distilleries to give feedback on the proposed bill, which needed some tweaking.
Alaska Distillery.
She has copies of all the letters of support for House Bill 309.
There's a major distilling in Fairbanks, Highmark Distillery in Sterling.
Shade says there was some pushback against the bill because it's helping an industry that creates alcohol. Rates of alcohol abuse are especially high in Alaska. But HB 309 puts restrictions on how many bottles and drinks distilleries can sell per person in the tasting room and what hours they can be open. They aren't allowed to have live entertainment or bar seating. In October, the new law went into effect. And on October 31st, Port Chilkoot Distillery opened its tasting room.
The Rosemary Gin Bubbly.
Okay.
It's a busy Thursday night, and tasting room manager Mackie Cassidy is mixing a drink for Sierra Jimenez.
Actually, this one, if you let it sit for a moment, the rosemary will kind of do its thing.
Yeah.
Cassidy is the distillery's first employee. She's part-time, but that could change once the tourists come to town. For now, most of the customers are locals.
Haynes 75 has been popular. That's the one with champagne and some cranberry and some vodka. And then the hot apple ginger toddies are kind of a hit tonight because it's chilly.
There's something fun about being able to go to the place something's made and try it there.
Haynes resident Jedediah Blum-Evitz is drinking his go-to cocktail, a gin martini. Cassidy hopes the tasting room will help infuse a cocktail culture in the beer-loving town of Haynes. And Shade says the tasting room will make her and her husband's investment into this distillery pay off sooner than they expected. In Haynes, I'm Emily Files.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Charles Enoch in Bethel, and Emily Files in Haynes. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Monica Goki. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quitline can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
Want to know more about how you and your family may get help buying health care coverage or avoid a tax penalty? Go to getcoveredak.org or call 211. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, a nonprofit health organization.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.